Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Petapixel Podcast. Catch new episodes every week on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to the Petapixel CarCast.
Oh, this is great.
We are. If the audio sounds weird, it's because we're in a car.
We're in a Honda Coupe, a very small car.
And we are going to do this as we're driving to San Francisco for a camera review. And the weather is terrible, but we're going to make the best of it. Jordan, do you have a question you'd like to ask us?
Yeah, I'd like to kick something off so the viewers and listeners can learn a little bit more about us. Guys, we're in a car. I want to know, what was your first car?
Oh. My first car that I had access to, because we were too poor to, like, I never got my own car.
Right.
So the first car I had access to was actually a Honda Accord as well, interesting enough.
Really?
And it was a coupe. It was
a two-door. Did you complain about the size of it back then, too, or
of
your expectations?
No, because I was the driver.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable.
No, it was great, and I did horrible things in that car, not only racing it, but also, you know, shenanigans and things that my mom still doesn't know about. So luckily, my mom does not listen to the podcast.
Well, and you also didn't say anything about it either. So even if she did, you didn't actually. Yeah,
your mom knows you've been up to shenanigans.
She's very proud of me.
My first car was a Toyota Tacoma Pre-Runner, single cab from 2002, I believe. I got it in 2004, like a used lease. And it is still like my baby in my mind. Like that was my favorite.
Yeah, you constantly talk about how you want to get a Tacoma again.
Yeah, I sold my Tacoma at the peak of like COVID car value.
Right.
So I think we bought that car for $12,000 in 2004 and I sold it for $8,500 in 2021.
Wow.
So like it kept all of its value basically.
And then Jordan still doesn't have his driver's license. So that was a quick talk.
That's incorrect. So.
Oh.
I mean, the parent loaner would be the Ford Windstar.
Learned in a Windstar?
That's what I drove around in my partying days. But the first one that I would somewhat belong to me is my grandparents let me use the Cutlass Supreme. I was like, from the early 80s, it was ginormous, like the cushiest seats you've ever seen.
What a POS.
But the really great thing about it was there was like a little bit of interference from the engine to the radio. So if you were listening to it, it sounded like an old Atari video game. As you accelerated, the radio would go like, as you were driving down, you'd hit a red light.
Wow.
And I thought this would impress women, and it did not.
No Cutlass Supreme.
I'm like, let me show you a trick.
No woman has ever been impressed by a Cutlass Supreme, or any car named after a sword, for that matter. So, yeah.
Great name, lackluster product.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, one more thing I'll add before we send it to the intro is that my car was selected for me by my parents, mainly my mother, because she didn't want me driving anyone around. She wanted me to have access to drive myself, but didn't want me to have to bear the burden of responsibility for other people.
But she did want you to help your teenage friends move apartments.
But that didn't work because I ended up cramming, like I would go skiing in that thing and we'd cram all in the front seat, which is far more dangerous than having a second cab.
Yeah,
she's like, you can go 4x4ing, but by yourself, Jared. All right, let's go to our intro.
This week, as all weeks, we want to once again thank our podcast sponsor, OM System, who are bringing you an unbeatable deal today. For outdoor enthusiasts and photographers, size and weight of camera gear often plays a big role. The OM System OM5 not only offers cutting-edge technology and unrivaled performance, but also ensures you have room in your bag for other essentials that you need in your adventure. The OM5 combines amazing image quality with lightning-fast autofocus, ensuring you never miss a moment. You could pair it with the MZWICO, M-Digital 14-150, f4-5.6, and experience freedom and capture the world like never before. That's a huge zoom range. That's like a wide angle to like super telephoto. For a limited time only, OM System is offering an exclusive spring promotion on this pairing. When you purchase the OM5 camera and the MZWICO Digital ED 14-150 f4-5.62 lens together, you'll save $550 off the regular price. Adventure enthusiasts and photography fans alike can now own this incredible kit for just $699.99, $700 US. Yeah.
That's
sick
that's
deal.
That's a very good price.
And that's going to sound like I scripted that, but I legitimately think that's a good deal.
That's a really good deal. That's a steal considering the quality and performance you'll experience with this fully weather-sealed camera and lens combination. Don't miss out on capturing your adventures with OM System. Head to your nearest authorized retailer or visit explore.omsystem.com/petapixel. That last part's important. I dropped a cable to take advantage of this amazing offer before it ends on April 28th. 2024.
Nice deal. Speaking of spring, we are in San Jose, California, because we're here for a very exciting project. It was awesome to see the brand new LSST camera, and that video is out, and it's something you should watch for sure.
Is it out? I don't think it's out yet.
It'll be out, but that's why we're here in California. And speaking of spring, it's raining like crazy. So the OM5 would be excellent because it's weather sealed. It would absolutely handle this no problem. But Jordan, do you have a raincoat for this trip?
I don't. No, I've got like this, my fuzzy Falkland inner lining, which I thought was perfect for the temperature. But I think Jaron and I will agree the forecast shifted slightly.
Yeah,
when I was doing my initial
plan. I was unprepared as well, so I don't have a raincoat either.
So we can say what we're doing. We're out shooting the X100 6.
Yes.
Video.
Full review.
There was a little, because it is weather sealed, but only if you've got an adapter lens on it or the filter adapter with the UV filter. So we're going to try and be a little cautious. I'm a bit concerned because I actually get to film on the X100 6.
Yeah, you're going to break it.
And
Jordan's going to break the
camera. I'm going to have exposed microphones, exposed ports on it. It's all terrifying.
Oh, so my gosh.
The rain should stop. That's what they say. But it's supposed to be stopping now and it's still raining, so I have also concerns. But
so this will come out before the X106 video, so we can just keep people in suspense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tune into the podcast to find out if Jordan actually did break the camera. Confucius says highly likely. So now that we're here in California, we decided to do something else. So, you know, there was a little bit of banter back and forth about whose cooking was better.
Yeah, on the podcast, right after the Oscar episode.
Yeah.
Where you made lasagna for me, and I said it was fabulous lasagna.
Yeah.
And then Jaron said, like, that is total BS lasagna.
I said... You haven't had my lasagna. I'd love to serve it to you.
You know what's great? This is a podcast. We could go to the tape if we wanted.
I believe that Chris argued his was better than mine.
I did not. No.
I'm sure
I simply said that Jordan had it and said it was like the best lasagna he's ever had in his life. Anyway, so we had a bit of a cook-off, and we're going to go to that now. And if you're watching on the YouTube channel, you are going to, I think, thoroughly enjoy this experience.
If you are not watching on YouTube, if you're listening to the audio only, we're not going to subject you to it because it's kind of just a lot of instrumental
music.
A lot
of visuals.
Yeah.
But we encourage you to go watch it if you want to on the YouTube channel. And so
you don't want to miss it.
You don't want to miss it.
You want to see who won.
Okay, so Jaron, how does it feel to be the unquestioned victor in this?
I mean, unquestioned?
Honestly, again, I can't say enough. This was extremely close. Like I was debating. It was an internal battle going on.
Chris was very upset.
I wasn't up. No. Okay. So for those that have watched it, you just saw. I was actually incredibly gracious. Mm-hmm. Jaron was a sore winner. and I was very gracious. His lasagna was great. I even said so. And then this morning, just to give extra context, we reheated the lasagna for breakfast.
I wasn't even going to bring this up.
Yeah, but I'm going to. And Jordan had both. And then he's like, again, you're like, oh, Jordan's reheats fantastically well. Anyways.
I said the same about yours.
Yeah, exactly. But did you have to, like, do a second, like... Again, you specifically
asked me to.
Oh, man.
You said, like, which one's better reheated? Now, Jordan, you brought this upon yourself, so you can't be furious.
I can't. Of course I can be furious. Anyways.
At any rate, I hope you all enjoyed that.
Tension is high within the car this morning.
I'm getting out. Pull over. Pull the car over. I'm done.
No, it's a freeway. I'm not doing that.
Oh, okay. That would be a horrible walk in the rain. Never mind.
So let's talk about the weekend news, and it was surprisingly busy. Leading up to NAB. I don't know if that had to do with anything. NAB is, by the way, the National Association of Broadcasters show in Las Vegas.
I'm going. One of the last big trade shows left.
I'm going tomorrow.
Yeah.
What do we got, Chris? Why don't you start us off?
Okay, so everybody loves AI, so let's just talk about AI, right? I mean,
everybody
we have to every week.
Oh, man. But, okay, so this is kind of interesting. So Adobe is really getting on the AI game where they want to start cataloging and teaching their machines about video. And so Adobe's actually going to pay not everybody, sorry folks, you can't just like go and send footage and get paid, but Adobe is going to pay up to $7.25 a minute for footage that their experts and professionals and video creators that they already work with are making. So they're obviously trying to get like facial expressions under different kinds of light, all that kind of stuff. And any potential actors who are looking to get into Hollywood, you don't get a job. It's over. It's done for you.
I feel like the takeaway from this is that with like Sora existing,
yes,
and them refusing to say what they trained it on, which is
obviously YouTube.
Yeah.
Everybody knows.
It's got to be copyrighted content, but they say publicly available, which doesn't mean it's not copyrighted. But like Adobe is trying to do this in at least an ethical manner.
Yes.
I mean, none of us have to like it, and you don't have to like Adobe, but you do have to admit that if you look at the way they're doing AI, they are only training it on stuff they have the right to do so on.
And they're paying for it.
Yes. Which, I mean, I'm not a big AI guy. I don't like where AI is going. I don't find AI-generated content that interesting. It's great for like Dungeons and Dragons when you need to create a character and show people what they look like. That's basically the only format that I think it's great for. But other than that, I'm just like not into it. But at least with Adobe, if they're gonna do it, they're at least not stealing from you.
Yeah.
To do it.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah, sure. That's the reason that, like, if you're looking at Firefly, it seems a few generations behind.
Right.
What we're seeing from it's other people
who
are just absolutely stealing content from, like,
sure.
You know, like, I love how we were seeing, like, little Reuters things when you try and recreate, like, a sports scene.
It's, I think,
like,
it was obvious. Getty. It was, like, Getty, yeah.
They were getting the Getty image. Yeah. But then, I think the same thing with video here. It's just going to take them a lot longer to have something competitive compared to Sora, where it's just taking all of YouTube. But I think they're kind of hedging their bets on how things are going to go legally, because the courts could just say, like, you know what, all of OpenAI's stuff, it's been using information it doesn't have access to, strike that whole thing down. And now all of a sudden, Adobe has this massive lead because they've spent years now trying to get access legally to their information.
There was actually a bill. This is not one of our stories that was in our docket, but it's worth pointing out. Senator, I think one is Schumer. I can't remember. One of the senators,
yeah, Schumer.
Was it Schumer? I even wrote the story and I can't remember. He introduced a bill that would require companies to disclose if they used copyrighted content, and if they don't, face a fine. I don't know how you catch someone not telling the truth in this, but at least the government is, some people in the government are trying to think ahead.
Which is great, but if we're going to be cynical, Adobe's going to get past any sort of legal issues by paying this money, but some people are getting like $3.50 a minute. It's up to $7.25. That's creme de la creme. And it's not a ton of money. I mean, you know, like if you're contributing a 20-minute clip and you're getting, what, $150 max, like that's not a huge amount of money.
Yeah, so, some people would say, what is that, $150 to sell your soul in the future of your career?
Yeah, like that. So people aren't going to get rich off of this.
Right.
Yeah. People aren't going to get rich off of this. Regardless, it's going to be great when we have AI girlfriends and all of our content is made by AI.
It's
we don't have to interact with humans anymore.
To this every,
yeah.
Team. I can't wait.
What if you could just generate a version of yourself that would just read all of your scripts for you and you wouldn't have to leave the house?
It's already been done.
I mean, there's a lot of Chris out there. So, I mean, if Sora's just, scanning all of YouTube, then it has a very convincing Chris Nichols.
I bet you can make it.
When we get access to Sora,
we should try and do.
We'll tell him, make a video of Chris Nichols walking down a street explaining a camera and see if it can do it.
I bet you it'll do a good job, but my hands will look weird. We'll see.
What's next on the docket?
So Panasonic S52 and S52X.
Yeah.
Yes, you love this platform, Jordan, as you should, because it is a great platform. And firmware, brand new firmware updates. We heard about this actually a little while ago, and this is exciting stuff. I mean, yes, there are the usual improvements to things like autofocus and image stabilization. You do want to talk about. But there's also a very interesting connection, again, oddly enough, to Adobe, which we should also address.
Yeah, so they've added Frame.io support, which has become just huge in the like high-end video production world.
For those that might not know, Frame.io is, it comes with Adobe subscriptions. It's a cloud-based storage system.
It's directly to cloud is what's cool about it.
Yeah.
So, as you know, if you set up a Wi-Fi network as you're shooting, all of those files are just immediately dropping into a server that your editors could have access to. And it, basically, Frame.io is really targeted like professional industries, like especially a lot of documentary, you know, where you've got multi-camera on a reality show, for example, that footage is just coming in constantly. But Panasonic is kind of targeting it as a different audience of like really quick turnaround for low to mid budget
filmmakers and photographers.
Yeah.
So they highlight at wedding shooters specifically. So while you're shooting, every time you stop a recording, that file, as long as you still have access to a network, whether it's on your phone or there's like a local Wi-Fi in the venue, it's going to send it right over to your editor so they can work on doing same day edits, which is something that's become hugely popular. Yep. Like you can charge a massive like premium over other
it's people. Nice to have the redundancy too of having your files uploaded for safety's sake. You know it's stored on the cloud. Then you don't have to go through even just the mundane plug in a USB cable or plug in your SD cards and dump all your footage. Like it'll already be there waiting for you. So it's a really nice convenient setup.
But you say redundancy. Now the thing to remember is this is only gonna save with photos, you're getting full size JPEGs, HEIFs, or RAWs. Those are all gonna move over. But yes, your video files are going to be low resolution proxies, low data rate.
Which is fine for people who want to start editing like immediately. That's what's
And then you can pass them, it has the same file names as your actual full-size card.
So
they're editing it, you get to the end of the venue, they plug the memory card in with the full-size files,
and
applies
that
to all the high-res, and drops it out. But it is a very cool technology, but in order to accomplish that, they had to add proxy recording, which is something that's really weird Panasonic has to offer because they have such a huge leg up with video production.
I always assumed they had it.
No, they've done redundancy, which I love, so you can get full-size images to two cards, but not a super compressed proxy to one.
But now you have it.
So is this the first? I mean, of course, we've had cameras for many years now where you can go to a smartphone app or something like that, move your files over, and then from there to whatever. But is this the first major company where we've got files going directly to cloud-based storage?
No, so Fujifilm has been doing it for a while with their latest, the X-H2S, X-H2 and X-T5.
I think the X-106 might as well.
I think that'd be hilarious. But I mean, it could make sense as like a second shooter camera to just have those JPEGs going in, but they've gone about it in the more classic way. It's uploading the full resolution files to the server. And again, they're targeting, like if you talk to Adobe, they're like, okay, this is for commercial filmmaking, things like that with the X-H2S. They've gone kind of a different way with the Panasonic, but I think it is definitely very interesting.
You may see other companies start to jump on board if they start to realize
this. I think it's really smart.
Really taken off.
It's a different way to do it. I did really quickly want to touch on the other improvements because I've been using the G9 II as my primary camera. First of all, because I love those Micro Four Thirds 1.7 lenses, but also I did definitely notice autofocus is more consistent with that camera by far. Compared to the S5 II, 2X, and the stabilization does do a really good job of, I mean, I just call them the Canons now, but the kind of, if you're using a wide angle lens, the warping at the edge of the frame, that's really extreme. And it's not a matter of like bad software or anything. That's what you actually see at the edges of the frame if your sensor is moving around. And Panasonic's doing digital correction to that, which works excellent. It's very similar to like Olympus had their enhanced IS mode 1. That I always said was the gold standard for video stabilization because it eliminated the warpies. The Panasonic now looks almost identical.
Wow.
And you're getting access to that in a full frame camera for the first time, which is really cool. Panasonic, and they're neck and neck now for like the best firmware company, I think.
There you go.
They're slaying it right now.
All right, next story. So this is exciting. Leica has a brand new phone. It's the Lights Smartphone 3. But they're pairing some big sensors in there, 1-inch sensors. But Jaren, are you Japanese?
No.
I'm only half Japanese. I don't live in Japan. Jordan, are you Japanese?
I am not at all Japanese.
Not even a little bit?
No, I know. Feel free to judge me.
That's too bad. So it turns out none of us are going to get this phone because it is unfortunately Japan only.
Yeah, this is the Lights Phone 3, the third one they've done. I feel like the other two were also Japan only. Yeah.
I think the first one was in Europe. I seem to recall.
Maybe I'm thinking of like that. I think Sharp had like an Aquos, which was basically the same as the Lights phone.
Yeah.
And it was only in Japan. But now they're just basically taking the Leica name and just selling it there.
Yeah.
What I liked about this, and I'm a little
bit. You like it about it?
What I liked about it was that there are some new features. Like the actual hardware of this phone, other than the processor, the camera system is all the same as the previous one.
They added
new modes that allow it to mimic an actual Leica camera better.
A few Leica optical formulas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they not only did that, and they added other looks as well to mimic other like Leica style. They look really cool, and I'm kind of disappointed that it's not something that more people will get a chance to use. I'm really not sure why Japan was chosen only for this phone. Do you guys have any suggestion why that would be?
I Obviously, it's going to be a very expensive phone.
Yeah, they didn't tell me how much it was going to cost, by the way.
It's Leica, so it's going to be expensive. And, you know, and so I guess they feel like maybe the Japanese market, they enjoy the cachet of all these fun different products. I mean, we see this with a lot of products in Japan. They get a lot of cool stuff that they just don't think flies in European or North American markets. Also, I think it's just incredibly hard to break into North American phone markets.
Well, even if offering it in Europe would have been fine.
Right.
That's the thing that's surprising, because it's a European company.
Or China?
I do really wonder if it's just like, look,
a test?
Smartphones are not something where people are willing to wait 6 months to get delivery on it. We can only produce a very small amount of these with the rubberized texture that is reminiscent of a Leica camera. I mean, parts of it are actually being
premium polyacrylic
texture.
Maybe
they're like, look, we can only make like 500,000 of these things. What's a market where we can sell that many?
I'm positive that these are not being handmade in Germany like the rest of their stuff. So they must have co-opted with another smartphone manufacturer.
Right.
And purchased a small order of them and decided they could probably move them all in one specific country.
Yeah.
Maybe the exclusivity was neat. They only have to design the OS in one language.
Right.
Damn, you can put a a micro SD card in this thing up to a terabyte of expandable storage.
3.5 millimeter jack on it. Hot dog.
Yeah.
So I do want to touch on the looks and the depth of field really quickly. So the looks, they're doing the exact same ones that we're seeing where you can add those looks to your Leica cameras now. So
yeah,
by using the Photos app, you can, that's what it's called, right?
Like Photos.
Yeah.
Photos.
Yeah, with an F.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can now have the same look on your smartphone images and your actual camera. And the cool thing about their depth of field simulation is it is actually based on Leica lenses.
Yeah.
So like the 50 millimeter f1.2, the 35 1.4, and the 28 1.4.
Yeah, fallout, you're gonna get the same kind of everything.
Yeah, I think that's really smart too, and I'd love to see that kind of like selectable.
Not to mention the fact that we're talking about a 47 megapixel sensor, 1-inch type, and it's in front of a 19 mil f1.9. So I mean, you're gonna get some natural shallow depth of field anyway.
Totally.
So yeah, it's absolutely aimed at creators, people who want to have fun with their photos, go a little bit further. I
saw some of the example photos taken with it at full resolution. They were sent to me. We weren't able to upload those to our site because
Right.
our site doesn't really support like a light box or anything like that
right
now. But I noticed that the pictures that were taken of not people looked spectacular. Like I was like, these look really nice.
Right.
I saw a couple portraits and I'm like, these look kind of crunchy. Like,
okay.
I don't love the skin texture. Now, if you look at the pictures on Petapixel, I have linked the story in the description below.
Yeah.
They look really nice when you're seeing them as if, I think, what you would see them on a smartphone or like on social. They look fine. But if you see them at full res zoomed in, it's not my favorite.
Not your cup of tea?
Yeah, it wasn't my favorite. I would like to see some pictures taken that weren't like by the company.
Right,
so I actually asked to see if we could even get one of these. Just out of curiosity, so we'll see. I didn't get an answer yet.
Okay.
It's probably no.
Right.
But like, I'd love to be able to see this used by real people and see what they come up with, because I wasn't super into the image that was provided.
Regardless, though, Leica is really good. They're always very good about making their photos unique looking, providing people with sort of a tonality and texture and color that you just don't see with other products. And they've really added a whole bunch of filters. I mean, they got a nice vivid filter, they've got muted tone filters. I mean, they're really they're aiming creative photographers. Yeah. And so it's one of those things where you're like, I'd love to play with it. I get that maybe there's not a big market, but I think a lot of photographers would love to get their hands on it. And I don't know, I guess you're gonna start learning Japanese. And
I love the idea of a consistent look from your main camera to your smartphone as well. And like, as the only company who's like, look, it's the same profiles you've got on your main
camera. Photos app is actually really good.
It is.
It's really good. All right, so we should mention one more thing. Now, we already talked about this story. Nikon was in the process of acquiring RED, and this is a big coup for the industry. You know, a photo company buying out a huge cinema company. And this is pretty incredible, because you always expect these things to have some red tape, some bureaucracy, timing, you know, negotiation, but it's done.
Yeah,
it's over.
When we first arrived in California just days ago, we were talking like, how long is this going to take? And then what happens?
Yeah, then they announce it like the following day. Clearly they were quite far along in the process before they made this information public. I almost wonder, because they announced it at a bizarre hour, with absolutely no,
yeah, yeah,
nobody knew. Like Jaron and I were just texting at like 11:30 at night, like, what the going. I'm sorry.
Whoa! You never sworn on the podcast, and then Nikon acquiring Red is the one thing that makes you do it.
Now I gotta add a beep in. Jeez, sorry, Jordan.
Oh, Jordan.
Time code is 24 minutes 50 seconds. But I was very surprised by it. So I wonder if maybe it was about to leak and they wanted to just get ahead of it. Clearly, they were quite far along on this. It's no longer a hypothetical. We can really start talking about the impact.
It's happening.
Nikon and Red. And Jaron is going to NAB and he's going to be speaking.
Yeah, I actually got a sit-down meeting with Nikon/Red to talk about this acquisition. We sent them like 15 questions. I'm interested to see what they have to say. We'll definitely dissect that interview after I publish it when on the podcast. We'll get your guys' opinion on it. But Jordan had half of those questions were his. So we'll see what they say.
He wants to know a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I'm curious. And I really want, what I'm most curious about is how long it takes for the consumer to actually see the results of the acquisition. Yeah. When are we going to see something happen that's like, very obviously Nikon is now involved. Yeah. Like the one that I can see happening almost immediately, it can't take that long seeing the ZF Z mount lenses on Red cameras.
Yeah. I think they'll start ship. I mean, it's gonna take longer for hardware. I'm really curious about the software things. Like, are we just gonna see Red code immediately drop as a software update for Nikon cameras?
Would you like that?
I would. I think it's my favorite RAW format to work. RAW support for video has made huge strides in the last few years. It used to be like Red was easy to work with and everything else was completely unmanageable, and it's gotten a lot better in the last few years, but I still find like just how responsive Red code is. And more important than that, we've been waiting forever for support of Nikon RAW. Like, it's only been available in DaVinci Resolve and a few smaller ones. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing native support in Adobe, native support in Final Cut, where Red code is supported by everything, because it's been the same basic format now for like 15 years. I think that would be great. All of the
same
drop Red code, all of our programs are going to support it, especially a lot of like VFX programs and stuff like that. Native Red RAW support, it's a standard workflow.
More importantly, are you wearing headphones because your ears are cold because it's yucky outside?
No, I'm actually, it's a shame the viewers at home can't see the enormous pile of crap I have.
You got an H pile. Don't unplug stuff. Wait a minute.
Sorry, everyone. I upped the audio on that. I tried to lift it up and demonstrate it. So
don't do that.
Jordan's crotch is gently cradling Zoom H5n and a whole bunch of labs, and hopefully it's working. We'll see.
It didn't work a second ago. Sorry about that, everyone. Right. Okay.
Well, while we congratulate companies like Nikon and Panasonic on their wonderful updates to firmware or acquiring big companies, our main story we are going to be crapping on all of the companies is going to be exciting. We are leaving nobody out. But I do want to mention we have actually a brand new sponsor for our main story. Let's do that. Jordan, are you terrified by AI?
Yeah, it's scary, man.
Yeah, Jaron, are you excited for AI and its take over the world?
I feel like I already said that it's not my favorite.
Okay, well, Neurapix is a company that deals with AI, and I have to say I do like the way that they're approaching AI. It's not scary at all.
Yeah.
Because I'm absolutely concerned with AI software taking control away from me as a photographer, taking away my choices, my creative control. But Neurapix does something very cool. It's very different. Their software learns your very own photo editing styles, okay? So it then applies those in Adobe Lightroom Classic. So in as little as 20 images, you know, you're working on files like you normally do, editing stuff the way you like, doing the changes you like, Neurapix will learn that, and the more images you give it, the better it gets. This saves you tons of time because before you know it, your photos will be automatically edited to your style within a short amount of time. And that's really nice because I do find when I'm in Lightroom, I am basically applying very similar sliders, very similar controls. And if you use a preset, it applies fixed slider adjustments to all your stuff, but Neurapix will evaluate each photo individually and apply different settings in your style that you would use for that. So it saves you a ton of time. So like 100% of what your style is, 10% of the time. The other cool thing about the software, it doesn't require a separate app because it goes right through Lightroom, so you don't have to worry about extra software or anything like that. The prices are cheaper than the competition, and you can either pay a flat rate to have local access, or you can pay per picture right through the Neurapix servers. So definitely check this out. I mean, if this is interesting to you, click the link in the description below, learn about Neurapix, go to neurapix.com, and I think this is really cool because it's all the style and changes you would normally make. It's just saving you tons of time. And that's what AI should do. It should not be our overlord. It should be working for us.
So not part of the ad read, just total editorial here. when we first heard about NeuroPix, I was working with one of our writers, David Crew, and he and I were both like, I don't know. Well, he tried it, and he came back to me and was like, I don't know, dude, this works way better than I thought it would. It works really well. And this was back when NeuroPix first launched.
Right.
And it took a lot more photos. It took like a couple hundred for it to learn your style. They have gotten a lot smarter, obviously.
A lot smarter, faster.
It'll get, I think 20 is the minimum. It gets better the more that you give it.
The more you get, yeah.
But it does actually work. I will say that from an editorial perspective, I can confirm it works. But I am happy that they're advertising. That makes me happy too.
I do wish I had a better starting point every time I open my photos in a way that I would do it, right? Like, I don't want to download other people's presets and mimic their looks. Like, I have what I like to do. It would actually save me a ton of time for what we're doing on the show.
And I should mention as well, if you're just listening to the podcast, don't click the link in the description below. Go to the episode description in your podcasting app, and the link
or
will be available.
Or neuropix.com. It's Neura with an A, NeuroPix.
Yes.
All right. So,
what is our main story, Jeff?
The main story is something that I've been thinking about for a couple of months now, and it's that I think it is, we're at that point where it is inexcusable how bad software made by camera companies
is.
And now we should differentiate. We're talking desktop.
Apps are actually great.
Yes. But some more than others.
Sometimes.
Fujifilm's doing a good job. Leica is doing a good job. We've mentioned that, yes.
But I think that all the desktop apps are bad to some degree.
And I think it's also important to point this out. This isn't like a new thing.
No.
We've been in this business for a long time. We're often playing with pre-production cameras where there is no RAW support other than, oh, here's a beta version of our software, whether it be at the time Nikon Capture NX or, you know, like Imaging Edge by Sony and stuff. And every single time, every single reviewer without fail and journalist, it's just a heavy sigh or a groan.
Whole room full of people just like, yeah, you can process our files through our software.
For a while there, I would say it was still forgivable that their software was awful because there was no reason the average person would have to use it.
Yes.
However,
it's been that over a decade.
So there's that, the fact that they've had 10 years to make their software not terrible, but also many of them are now putting features that if you want access to, you have to use their software.
Yes. Yeah.
And if their software is bad, that is a bad experience for everyone. I just don't think that's acceptable in 2024. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna rank these from least bad to most bad based on our experiences. And we actually, Jordan went and tested most
updated versions, current versions of everyone's software
to confirm that our opinions are still valid. So let's start with the least terrible.
And we're gonna go best to worst.
This is fun because I'm not gonna start with one and say like this is banging software. All of these are annoying.
Bad. Yeah, nobody does a good job. Let's make that incredibly clear. Nobody does a good job.
Right.
So at the one that aggravated me the least, right off the top, we're gonna go with the legacy program SilkyPix, which I think has been popular because it's Japanese software that a lot of the Japanese camera companies were including with their software. I mean, you've heard of this for well over a decade.
Yes.
And it does what it's supposed to. It opens up, it lets you adjust your RAW files and export them as a
JPEG. Wait, it opens up is a big deal for software?
Well, wait, just wait.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
Yeah.
Now, I was complaining, this is incredibly cryptic software, because basically, it opens up, everything is icon-based on it.
Yeah.
Except if you hover your mouse over the icons, it doesn't tell you what that is. You have to actually click on it, and it'll bring up a box that says, like, oh, this is exposure control that you've selected here, or contrast.
So you're saying the user experience is not very
initially, you're going to open it up, and it's going to be terrible experience, but eventually you can learn your way through it. It opened things up quickly. Export times were fine. So SilkyPix, I'm going to say yes. I still would far rather, with all of these, use like Capture One, Lightroom, an actual, you know.
What I like best about SilkyPix is I've used it quite a bit. We have to remember SilkyPix is unique because other companies have used it in the past too. Fujifilm did for a while.
Yeah.
You know, like it's been around the block, right? Everybody's had a ride. So, you know, and what's great, SilkyPix is, you know, anyways, lascivious at best. So what's great about them though, it's quick. That is one of my main complaints with a lot of the other softwares is just how slow and frustrating it is to watch processes happen, to open files,
processes?
To processes. Yeah, Jordan's looking at me like I'm an idiot, and it's totally proper grammar. And so anyways,
let me know in the comments.
You make me so mad. And anyways, it's quick because a lot of these other softwares, it's so clunky and so brittle. So good on you, Silky Picks.
We wouldn't say that Silky Picks is good.
No.
But it is...
The best of the worst.
Is it? Yeah.
I opened it up. I edited a photo. And it
didn't crash.
Good, and I exported it. And yeah. There were no problems. Okay. Number two. We're going to go to Nikon's NX Studio. Nikon used to... do you remember they used to have like a paid... NX.
Oh man, I used the hell out of Capture NX back in the day because I had no choice for a lot of the cameras. And yes, you had to. There was a time where you would get NX View for free, which was a cheapo viewer, kind of bridge-esque, very basic. And then you would you could pay, and I think it was like 150 Canadian or something, to get Capture NX, and it unlocked things like tethering along with raw processing. And very few people did it because. Capture One and Adobe were already kind of taking over at that point.
And their big thing was like, hey, with our software, we've got all the corrections for all of our lenses, which would wind up in the other, you know, major ones like a month later. You know, you weren't getting a huge head start. But then they've streamlined everything into NX Studio, which is kind of like Viewer and Capture combined together. Yes. And honestly, not terrible. I opened it up. It opened up quickly. We were able to. The previews did take a while to load, which is funny.
Didn't they just update this software?
It's pretty recent.
I feel like they're actually trying right now. So like, that's thumbs up to them actually trying. Yeah. I guess so.
I mean, we'll talk about that.
What issues do you have with it?
So the biggest issue. This is something we're going to bring up all the time on this third-party software. Is when they give you a huge list of editing tools. With little drop-down arrows, and their entire interface is just like you unclick the arrow, and if you want to have multiple editing options open at the same time, you're just scrolling down and up endlessly, as opposed to like properly organizing the way a workflow actually works, like Lightroom does, you know, with its different modules at the top of the screen, or you know, Capture does on the left side.
You can just totally
it's not designed
so much,
the way
right?
actual human beings edit images, but again, I was able to. Open up files, make quick and easy edits, export it as a JPEG. It did what it was supposed to.
But you weren't having fun while doing it.
No, I'm just... why can't I see this option? Oh, right, I unclicked that arrow again. It's just... It's Funky. Bad design. It's Funky. Not It's not abnormally bad design. It's just badly designed.
There's a Cybertruck in front of us, guys. Want to look at it?
I don't want to look at it. They're ugly.
What did
it's
you
a
say
washing
like?
Machine on wheels.
Still makes me laugh.
Right? All it right. looks like my stainless steel at home.
Sorry.
Right.
Sorry for the sidetrack there. I pulled the Chris Nichols.
Oh man, distracted. All right.
What's the next one? What's the
right below that? This is the bane of my existence personally, in a lot of cases. There's worse, definitely.
This is one we have to use quite a
bit. We have to use it quite a bit, and that's Canon Digital Photo Professional.
Okay, this one I have an opinion on too.
Yes. So the interface used to be absolutely terrible. It's now
bad.
It's still terrible, just not absolutely.
It's mostly
terrible.
What is the standout badness? I want you to address this right off the top here, because it is maddening.
So it is really bad. They didn't change this about it. It's always been this way, and it's bad. They used to also include some skeuomorphic controls or whatever that just looked horrible, but now it's just bad. What happens, so you open up a window, and that shows you your files, and if you open up anything, it then opens up two more windows.
Yes.
One of them is just a floating photo, your photo floats. The other one is a floating control panel, and behind that is still the like import thing.
It's so, like you have three separate apps open at the same time.
Simultaneously. I also don't like that whenever you download anything Canon, it downloads a lot of stuff.
Yes.
And your computer is suddenly filled with all these applications that you didn't necessarily think you needed, but maybe you were convinced you did. And then you can't remember which one of them is the one that actually opens the pictures if you try and use it later in the future. You're like, which one of these did I need again? And you always end up opening the wrong one. I've opened a file like eventually like down the road. I was like, oh, I have this. I don't have to download it from Canon. I've got it. No, I have an old version. It no longer is supported. It doesn't work. I have to go delete it, uninstall everything, and then reinstall everything else because it doesn't have I don't think it has a built-in updater. You have to restart to do anything.
Chris, what would you say is the experience of actually editing a photo?
Well, so there's no endless scrolling, which is nice because you just have to as a Windows user, I'm used to having multiple windows over top of other windows.
Yeah, like Windows 98.
And the frustration of that. But my main problem with Digital Photo Professional Pro is it's just slow. It's slow.
Oh, it's
slow to export. It's slow to apply. Like,
slow.
I hate making a slider adjustment and then having to wait to see the effect happen.
Curves? curves when you have to wait is so frustrating.
Yeah, it's so strange to me because this is a universal experience on any processor with any GPU.
Yeah.
For the last decade, it has been terrible.
I'm never cutting 8K raw video on my computer, and then I open up Canon Photo Professional.
Like, this is slow.
Oh no, this file's 32 megapixels. This is going to take forever.
It's incredibly slow.
It's actually baffling to me how badly optimized this software is.
Yeah.
And it has always been this way.
Do you think it's running a Windows 98 emulator?
Like in the background?
No, Windows ME.
It
goes through a proxy emulator.
That's what's taking so long, is it has to fire up entirely.
Yeah, you got to open up DOSBox to run Canon Digital Photo Professional.
So this is my least favorite. It's clearly not your guys' least favorite, but
no.
I think I've used it the most because over the years I've
been a Canon user.
Canon shooter. And the reason it's also on here is there is a feature that is locked to using this. And most people probably have forgotten it exists.
Yeah, there's the Canon dual pixel RAW, where it gives you a RAW file using the information from the dual phase detect pixels.
For anyone who's like, well, no, Adobe supports that. Incorrect. Adobe's official instructions are you have to first process it in Canon software, and then Adobe can read the RAW that it creates after that. That's the support. It's not the actual what you need to do the cool stuff.
If you import one of those files, it'll just read one of the two pixels in Adobe.
Luckily, nobody uses dual pixel RAW. And if you are one of those people that does use dual pixel RAW, you don't. So come on, give me a break. So this next one's a hot take, and maybe Jordan, like, this is more your experience. You had Hasselblad Focus, Phocus. It's been around for a long time. It's been the tethering software for Hasselblad studio cameras for a long time.
Yeah.
It's absolutely used in professional environments all the time, and yet you still don't like it.
Yeah, Jordan was frustrated last night with this software.
Yeah,
absolutely. So I brought in a RAW file for it, and it comes back to, Chris was actually mentioning this earlier, it's nice to have an easy starting point when you're working with a file. So when we dropped in...
When did you drop the cable?
That's just more cables that are all sitting on my lap right now. So we dropped some files in, and you see the JPEG preview when you bring in a Hasselblad RAW file, and what you see in front of you, it looks like a log image. It's just incredibly flat, no saturation to it whatsoever.
I'm sure there's a clickety-click box clicker somewhere.
It takes forever to load up the previews of these files as well.
Yes.
So once I got it in there, interface is still quite laggy, which is one of my pet peeves. But the big thing is I spent a few minutes and I was like, guys, can I get this file to look as good as the preview JPEG with the built-in tools?
You were not close.
No, it still didn't look good after I'd been like
looking really
around
bad.
With it. Yeah, and I just having only a recovery slider that brings down the highlight. But a lot of the time you want to just quickly bring highlights up and things like that. And again, you just lose saturation in those. It's not the experience I'm used to with, modern Adobe Capture One, where you can move the slider. And people will get used to it. Absolutely.
I'm sure with practice it gets better. You can have presets loaded and stuff like that too to have a good slider.
But it's ranked here because you, as like a new user who got their very first Hasselblad.
And I've been told, the image processing is just stunning on it. I would be immediately frustrated.
Can't even get it to look like a JPEG.
Yeah, and on top of that, I do want to give them credit. I've never had an issue with the tethering support on Focus.
Yeah, the tethering's quite
good.
I think
that works great.
And they do unique things with their sensors. I mean, the software is very well mated. Like, Canon Digital Photo Professional, I can't get a good result out of the software on their own files, right? But with Hasselblad Focus, yes, you can get really nice results working with it.
Yeah, with practice, I'm sure
I
could.
They've got good noise reduction, you get really nice color out of it, but
I would just use it to do those initial profiles where I'm doing noise reduction, things like that. Then I'd bring it over into software that makes it workable, which again, why do I have to deal with
most Hasselblad routine? Studio photographers, they're taking the shots, it's going to the computer, and they got some other poor person who has to actually do all the stuff in Focus.
A digital tech?
Yeah.
Okay, this was going to be last place until a surprising upset occurred. Sony Imaging Edge.
Yeah.
This is what inspired this conversation. When the A9 III came out, it is actually doing multi-frame blending because it can shoot 120 frames per second. That's just like a smartphone where you could have a bunch of images. You could do noise averaging with it to improve image quality.
Yeah.
Great stuff like that. But it's only available if you open this godforsaken
software
suite of programs.
And look, Sony does not have a fantastic history with making great software. on for cameras, period.
Yeah.
But it is not changed by the experience of this app. It's not good.
And we have, like, Sony knows, because multiple people have said this right to their faces. Like, and again, go back to the press trips. They'll talk about, oh, hey, okay, the new camera's got this great feature where you can do this computational photography. And of course, inevitably the question is, oh, can we do that in camera? And then inevitably the salesperson's like, well, no. You do go through our excellent Sony Image Hand software. And then again, universally just like a, Yeah, and they, you know, they clickety-clack on the type on the keyboard, because you know that's going to feature in the next article in big italics.
Well, and what's really concerning with what Sony is doing is their cameras, I'd say the processors are a little underpowered on it, because they can't do any of this stuff. And they're starting to offload more of the responsibility onto your computer at home with this atrocious software that is, like, we haven't gotten into specifics, but incredibly slow, constantly crashes.
Yeah.
This is what it's most famous for. When we were trying to test the A7 R5, I think it took us like 3 or 4 tries to get a pixel shift shot.
Yeah.
Back then, I think we were on like an M1.
You're iMac, waiting. It's slow.
It's so slow. And then it bricks, and then you try doing it all over again.
Yeah.
Like, it's completely untenable for
a
professional workflow.
To have so many cool features on a camera that are locked into using substandard software, I get it, but it is not what you would call convenient or good user experience. And I know that's kind of the name of the game for a lot of these softwares, but Sony is the most egregious at locking features away, forcing you to use it. The other companies aren't forcing you to use their software. They're just making it so you very likely will not want to.
Yeah, or like an incredibly niche thing, like dual pixel RAW.
Right,
like,
which nobody will use.
Yeah, multi-shot is way more useful than that. And again, the A9 III multi-shot, I can't speak to how effective it was, because when we tried to test it out, it just cratered. So.
But Leica lets you do it in camera, Panasonic, you do it in camera, OM System, you do it in camera. So, like, yeah, it's just a real issue.
This is going to be a really quick one, guys. Last place, and this is on a case-by-case basis. I really wanted to open up OM Workspace.
I know. And again, this is your experience. Oh, well, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So Jaren's going to now cut to this screen cap of my homepage with the beach ball here. And this sucker didn't open up. I restarted the computer.
Yeah.
I re-downloaded the software.
Yeah, you get the good old college try.
So, you know, your mileage may vary. I'm sorry, I can't. I've used previous versions of this.
Right.
And I remember it just being kind of a clunky thing where I just immediately... raw file to JPEG, export, work on
it. I have used
it
recently.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me what that was like.
It was okay, so it opens on a PC, no problem. So
I'm guessing it's the M chip.
Your particular PC.
Yes, no, yes, my Gigabyte Aorus, it did open up. So, and on my desktop as well. So, you know, it has crashed. It is slow. The user interface is not nice. So yeah, I would mark it alongside like the Canon product or something as far as usability. It's not great. It's clunky, it's slow, but
so
if you're a Mac user and you can't open it, that does leave out a large proportion of
photographers. I do actually disagree that it should be in the last place, even though you couldn't open it, because you don't need to.
Yeah.
If there's nothing in there that you desperately, as a photographer, would be like, I really wish it would open because I need to do this thing.
That's one of my favorite things with OM. It even saves a RAW file if you use those computational tricks.
Yeah, so you can do it in camera with OM. So I would argue, I'm with Chris, I think it should move. It's still a trash software.
Yeah, it's not great.
It should still
be. This is my rankings.
Your ranking puts it at the bottom because it can't open. Yeah. But I think it's somewhere next to Canon.
But there's no reason to use it. It's not fun to use. There's no reason to use it.
But there's no reason to use it.
Yes, the exposure controls. A lot of these companies I find... they really don't give you a lot of range for exposure control, for color correction. You know, it's really very limited.
It's to me, ironic.
Sometimes it's like exposure and curves and saturate. Like, that's all you get. Like,
these companies are the ones who are designing their own file type, and they are the worst at taking advantage of their own file type. That's what I said in the beginning. It is unacceptable that they're all so bad.
Yeah.
Like, either stop doing it entirely, like Fujifilm.
That's what
Leica.
I wanted to get
to.
The people who are like, we're doing a terrible job of this anyway.
Where's Leica? Where's Fujifilm?
Yeah, so Leica is throwing in just a free, I think it's like 3 months of Adobe Photographer's Package.
Which is smart in a way, because like that's probably what you're not using anyway.
And it already shoots DNGs.
Yeah, so it gives you a chance to get used to it, to to like it. And then, yeah, you got to pay like everybody else, but at least you're already into that workflow.
But it's something like a Leica photographer, they're going to wind up with that subscription anyway. So it's like a cool bonus thrown in. Exact same thing with Fujifilm.
They give
like,
you Capture One.
Giving you, you know, a trial of Capture One software where you don't have
which
to
which is a perfectly acceptable editing program as well.
And I will say this much about it. When I was in Japan for the X100 VI, raw files did not work in Adobe, of course, because that was brand new. But like 4 days later, by the time I got back to the United States, well before this camera was available to purchase, I was editing my raw files. So like
in Adobe.
In Adobe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like they were very fast. They were faster than anyone would need them to be.
Yeah.
So I think that Fuji is in a great place with that. And I think this was the correct decision. You do not need to make your own software. You do not need to license SilkyPix.
It's interesting that the companies, the majority of companies still choose to fund these software programs.
It seems like just a waste of
a lot of money.
I mean, I don't think they're spending a whole lot.
No,
because most of these designs do look 15 years old.
You got one person in a dark corner having to like do firmware updates and they just hate themselves. But you know, it's like, I get it. If you're going to offer a product and the output of that product one major way is raw, you kind of want to have a solution for people.
Well, it reflects badly on the brand.
It does.
This is people's first experiences.
Yeah.
They're excited to take their pictures, look at it. They're like, oh, I'll download the software. Right. And they're greeted with something that looks like a command.
And they're or they're trying to train them to just use JPEG. I don't know. Like, be like, we're going to scare you away from raw so bad you'll never want to go to it again. You know,
here's the other thing that's confusing to me. It's like, okay, so you make your own software. That's awesome. Great.
Yeah.
Even if it's not very good. But do any of those softwares actually let you update your camera's firmware through them?
Yes, they do.
Do they?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Most of the ones I've experienced is you have to download it to an SD card and stick it in.
No, I mean, Focus from Hasselblad has been doing that forever.
That's great.
You know, like Canon's pretty good about that. Nikon's good about that. Like,
so there's an advantage.
Yeah. A lot of companies are, of course, doing this through their apps as well now and the phone. So, yeah, you know, there are some benefits there, but it's not like it's hard to do. Although, again, there are some companies that, you know, they insist you use the software to update firmware. I'm old-fashioned. I don't always like that, but whatever. But, so all in all, pretty rough.
So this is our call. You have said this, Chris, that whenever you ask for something, it comes. So, like, this is...
Well, Sony, anyway. But we've been asking for this from Sony for a decade, and we're still there.
We would like to see either better workflow or interacting with the companies that do a good job, or please make something usable. That's all we want.
And if you are just a beginner starting out, honestly, it's not like we're trying to push you into this, but look at Lightroom, look at Capture One.
Yeah, we're not being paid to say this. They're just the legitimate, it's just the only good options.
Why does everybody use it? Because they are like legitimately some of the only. There's other, you know, of course, yes, there's the Darktables, there's GIMPs, there's all that, but.
And there's Affinity. Affinity,
yeah, Affinity, you know,
probably works too. Yeah. I haven't used it in a while, but I'm sure it works, Affinity Photo.
But just join Lightroom, one of us. And
And I do think, as Chris kind of touched on at the start, we're seeing actually pretty good mobile support from a lot of these.
Mobile's getting better because they know that that's a big market. And they know that smartphone users honestly won't tolerate crappy software because they just won't use it.
Yeah, I remember even in 2016, Canon's app on iPad was working great for me. I used it at my wedding as a photo booth. People took their own pictures with the app in it.
But I think that's where all the development is going.
Yeah.
It's just into those.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, tech support, we got lots.
Yeah, we would typically do what have you been up to, but you can obviously see what we're
driving
we're
in a car.
To.
We're actually driving right now through the lovely hills of San Francisco, just entering the outskirts, and it's not raining.
No, it's not raining, which is great.
It's gray.
Gray.
Not raining.
Yeah, that was a good, what are we up to? Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, so tech support, let's get into it. So, we've got an email from Far From London. I don't know if that means their name is Far or they're located far from London. I don't know if it's London, England or London, Ontario. Who knows? Anyways, this is Far From London. I've been doing studio portrait and street photography with my only camera, which is a Canon R5. Good choice. For the last 3 years, using RF zooms, the 28-70. Yes, you have strong arms, I can already tell. And the 70-200 f/2.8 in studio. And RF lightweight primes like the 28-28 and 51-8 on the street. With a second camera for street, I'd like to gain in three fronts. Better autofocus, weight, and weather sealing. And I have two options in mind. Fuji X100 VI, good luck. Oh, they have pre-order one in case. Or the Canon Canon R8. How would you compare these two for an enthusiast street photographer? Would I be more disappointed by the relatively low-tech and slow X100 VI, or by the beginner's-oriented interface and handling of the R8? Or perhaps, as I'm not entirely happy with either choice, I must save my money for an R5 Mark II, whenever that comes, to gain on autofocus, wait a year or two for a more well-rounded, weather-sealed, compact camera. Any thoughts on my confusing question?
Did he say that he thinks the X100 VI
Is slow? No, that it's low tech and slow as far as like maybe
the autofocus isn't compatible with speed, what we're seeing out of the best. You know, the Canon R8 is the latest
for street.
Loves the podcast. By the way, is there any reliable DIY way to seal non-weather sealed lenses on cameras permanently with epoxy, and then the lens will cease to function?
Whatever Jaron put on his finger after he cut.
Liquid Band-Aid. No, don't do it. You cannot seal lenses better than they're already sealed. So that's interesting. I mean, everybody loves the X100 VI. Because I'm a photographer who appreciates, you know, the
You actually don't hate the X100 VI.
I don't hate
you
the
X100 VI. You hate the 35mm.
And I don't want to buy into the hype of it. I mean, it's a fun camera, but it's a limited camera. So I stand by that. But I know you guys, everybody else has this like, just orgasmic lust for the X100 cameras.
I'm checking out. I've heard this one a lot.
But it's true. It's like, you know,
so
it's a camera.
Okay, so the thing is, the R8 is going to give you a very compact, very similar shooting experience to what you have.
And the handling's great.
With, like, fantastic autofocus.
Yeah.
But yeah, it can be a little bit frustrating. It's a more basic interface, for sure. The Fujifilm is a completely different type of shooting, which I feel like it really might break up your more professional work with your big lenses compared to, you know, using that Fujifilm.
With a blah interface.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, we're going to play with it today. We'll see. Like,
Stay tuned for the full review on the X100.
But, you know, we're not just talking our bums. Like, we've played with the pre-pros, which are almost final for a while. And Jaron has actually been rocking an X100 VI for quite a long time now, because he essentially refused to give it back. So we'll see what happens. He'll probably be in small claims court here pretty soon.
But he's in a very similar place where he's got professional camera R5 setup.
Yeah.
And you said you've been shooting all your pictures with the X100
VI. Yeah, I haven't used the R5 for anything other than a webcam since I've had the X100 VI.
And it's a great camera. It's weather sealed if you have an adapter on,
which
a lens.
I don't.
But it's still rugged, you know. The autofocus is improved for sure. So yeah, no, I get it. And I liked the 5 for street shooting.
We're going to get to a real case study this channel. Well,
yeah, and I think what he said was he was using the R5 for his, like, pro work, but he wanted a street photography camera, a small one.
Small, yeah.
I don't see the R8 being that different of an experience. No. To what you already
have. To get you in a totally different mindset.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the appeal, I think.
And, yeah, I mean, I'm shilling for Fujifilm, but I love this camera, and I would recommend it because it's great. And move on to the next question.
Oh. You're unnatural love. Okay. This is Andy Speakpipe. Let's listen to the Speakpipe. I hope this is the same Andy. I mean, we've got a few Andys and a few Logans. Here we go.
Hi, guys. Andy here. Love the videos. Love the podcast. I'm currently using a Nikon D750. And for a lot of the work I do, it's still great. Studio portraits, product photography, and so on. And in terms of picture quality and megapixels, it's all I need. But I also do quite a lot of event and party photography, and low light focusing is not the D750's strong point. My question is this: if I upgraded to a ZF, or when it comes out, a Z6 III, would I notice a major boost in low light autofocus, or would I be better switching system to something like the Sony A7 IV? Thanks very much.
So Andy, one of the main advantages of the ZF is actually they dramatically improved its low light focusing, and it can focus to incredibly low EVs. The number escapes me now, but it was quite ridiculous. I remember hearing it being like, really that low, like -5 or -6 or something EV? It's pretty great, maybe -8. Of course, it always depends on what aperture of lens you're using as well, what ISO. But yes, it'll focus just fine. And we, of course, don't know anything about a Z6 III, but I assume it will have a very similar, if not the same, autofocusing setup as the ZF does. We'll see. But yes, excellent focusing in low light. The Sony's are too, but I don't think you need to jump ship. I think you can use the same lens mount.
Yeah, I think you'll appreciate the fact that the cameras have basically the same interface, and like you'll be very familiar on if you stay on that.
Adapting lenses will be really seamless if you do want to use some of your DSLR lenses.
Yeah,
and remember, this is the first like sub pro body, because Z8, Z9 got the 3D tracking that I think you'd really miss coming from a D750. Yeah. It's a really nice interface. This will feel the same, except now you've got coverage across the entire frame, and as Chris mentioned, it'll focus better in low light.
The ZF is sexy too. I wouldn't say, you know, don't wait, get it now. I mean, again, we don't know when a Z6 III is out.
Hold one, see if you like the more, you know, a very traditional, like SLR style handling of the ZF, or if you like the handling of your D750, then the inevitable Z6 III that comes out
will probably feel more familiar. But yeah, the ZF is a very easy camera to use. All right, thank you. Email from Peter Adler. This is for Jaron. Hi, Jaron. A huge thanks for getting back to me. Look, he does.
Oh, yeah. So Peter had a back and forth with me in email because he had two really long questions.
Oh, that was those ones, yeah.
So like, I asked him politely to condense it into something that we could actually fit into the podcast.
All right. So at this point, I'm unsure if any questions are relevant for Petapixel, but I think it'd be boiled down to this. How far are we in terms of establishing a viable C2PA ecosystem that can be used by media, government organizations, businesses, and the general public? And how fast can we hope to get there? Just to give context, the version 1.0 of C2PA was ready in 2022. 2 years have passed, but the rollout seems to be slow moving. I mean, it's making progress. Are there good technical reasons for this, or is it down to actors not giving high enough priority?
There's cameras now. That's the biggest difference.
It took time. And I think the issue was that even though the standard was made 2 years ago, they didn't get companies to actually sign on to use it until like the last year or so, maybe a little bit longer. And then it takes time for those companies to take the standard and figure out how to implement it on their hardware.
Right.
So I think that we will start to see this ramp up now.
Yes.
I'm curious if we'll see it go to all cameras, or if these camera companies think they only need to put it in the ones they expect pros to use. I think that's the wrong way to look at it, because a lot of these companies don't really have a firm grasp on, like, they say in their minds, the Z8 and the Z9, those are pro. Anything below that is for consumer or whatever.
That's not
how it works. Pros use everything, and they will mix and match. So I'm hopeful that we'll see it across more. I do know that every major camera brand is signed on to use this format, even if they haven't done anything with it yet.
As long as the X106 gets it, am I right?
I would like that. I don't know if Fuji, I actually can't remember. I'm assuming Fujifilm is involved in it. I can't remember if they are.
Right.
But like, they should be at some point. At a certain point, all the companies are going to get
it. It's going to be an expectation.
I just want to say we're driving by the San Francisco Giants, Willie Mays.
Go Giants!
Jaron is a big fan.
Jaron just clipped his mic channel there. Yeah.
Peter Adler would also like to express sincere condolences to you for the passing of your father.
Oh, thank you.
And once again, thanks to Chris, Jordan, and you for an interesting and entertaining podcast. Best, Peter from Brussels. However, also PS, why don't you number the episodes of the podcast, you moron? He didn't write that. I just threw that in.
It's because it's not best practice, actually.
Oh, well, there you
numbering
go.
Numbering your podcast,
BP, man, no BP.
Is not best practice anymore. It used to be what was expected, but now all of the podcasting apps say you shouldn't number your podcast.
There you go. But thank you, Peter, for your question. Absolutely.
In case you're curious, we're in the episodes in the 40s. I believe this is episode 41.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, we've been rolling for a while. One last thing I wanted to just plug on that question there is that the first mainstream camera support came out 2 weeks ago.
Right.
So, yeah, don't worry too much about the rollout, because now we're actually seeing it with cameras people own, as opposed to an M11P that might sell, like, you know, a few thousand copies.
Right. Well, globally.
Yeah.
Next email?
Yeah.
All right. Afafase. Email. I have a pocket full of batteries for my two Sonys, you and us too. Yeah. One is the A7IV and the other is the little RX107. I have several batteries for each of them.
Cutie pie.
Some batteries seem to last much longer than others. Yeah. Is there a particular way to test them to sort out the wheat from the chaff? Can use an expensive battery tester. What am I looking for? As you can see, I'm a bit ignorant when it comes to electricity and lots of other things. We are too, but let's not go there. I think such a test, if it were easy enough, would be very useful. There's absolutely battery testers you can get, but I don't know many photographers that use them. Generally speaking, what you'll find is a battery starts to go when it charges faster than it ever did before. Like it says it's full way quicker than it used to, and then it will subsequently last shorter. And I mean, the short gist of it is every time that you use a lithium and recharge it, you're killing it a little bit. It has an inevitable decline on a curve to where it's not very useful, and that's absolutely normal. Most important things are try to cycle through your batteries. A lot of us will rely on the same battery over and over and over.
Are you calling me out here?
I'm calling all of us out here. You know, photographers go to the point where they put labels or markings or Sharpies so they can have a better idea. The other thing is lithium batteries, they don't like to be left empty or with a low charge. So you don't want to put a battery away in a camera, leave it in a closet, forget about it forever. You certainly don't want to drain a battery and not charge it again. If you're going to store it, make sure it's got a big charge in it before you store it. But also don't forget about it because it does damage them.
Yeah. And the other thing too is there is zero consistency with this. You will absolutely buy batteries that are brand name, exact same thing, and it'll just have less life,
sure,
you know, than some of your other batteries. So it doesn't necessarily mean you did a bad job keeping them. Just know, like, there is a huge variety to these. I have good batteries and bad batteries for all of the different camera systems I use.
And he says that to them every day. He's like, you're a bad battery. Bad battery. Spanks
I wake
them
up, I shame them. It's shocking little impact that has on their ability to perform.
Yeah, but it works on people. Okay, next, Alex's email. Hello, it's Alex here. Love your work, guys. Following and watching basically every video. Basically, but not every video. Oh, hi, Alex. After seeing your video about using Sigma lenses only, I got a question. I'm dreaming about a Panasonic S5 S5 II camera. I was wondering if it is enough reason to go for a Sigma 85mm 1.4 DGDN art lens over Lumix 85-1.8 for pictures. I already picked the Lumix 100-2.8 macro. Beautiful lens. Don't
love
get Jordan
lens
started. As my primary lens for macro work and now choosing between 85s. Can you suggest which way I should go, Sigma or Lumix? Thank you all.
Yeah, I've used the 85-1.8. Mm-hmm. A lot of the characteristics I love about the 100 are already present in that. We see this all the time. The Panasonic lenses are better for video shooting, breathing corrected, very similar weights across the board. But if you're worried about resolution, then the Sigma is sharper.
Sure. And, you know, you don't always need a 1.4 lens. I'd be the first one to say I almost never shoot an 85 at 1.4.
Yep. No way.
I know.
You stop down?
I stopped down. Wow. Yeah, I know. But, you know, sometimes I even shoot at f7.1 just because I'm crazy like that.
All the time he shoots
at 7.1. Just wild.
Many Ortiz gave him a hard time about it.
Everyone gives you a hard time about it.
It does. But hey, you know what? The Sigma 85-1.4 is an excellent lens. If you do want to have that shallow depth of field look once in a while, it is a good choice. And yes, Sigma do make some excellent primes.
Where I really love it is full body telephoto portraits. Yeah. That's where you really see difference between a 1.8 and a 1.4, and it's actually practical. You don't have one eye in focus, one totally out of focus. If you like that look, the 1.4s are the way to go.
Well, guys, we're in San Francisco, but we're now to our Never Read the Comments, which we always do. So let's get into those. Jay Parlar has an email here. Just want to write in and say that I loved Levi's Magic Hours doc. It was a lovely doc. Thanks for bringing him on, because otherwise I don't know that I would have heard about it. And that's why we're doing it. We want to get exposure for this very interesting story.
Check it out if you haven't yet.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very good, very moving.
Now, Jay Parlar does live in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and I'm lucky enough to be near an old one-screen theater that was previously struggling, but converted to a nonprofit and did a multi-million dollar renovation. They now do movies, live music, comedy shows. I mean, I think that really is the evolution to survive.
Yeah, when you have a dead zone, like, you know, January to March in movie theaters, you're bringing in almost no money.
Suddenly being able to do something else to keep it going.
Yeah.
It's possible for these sorts of places to survive. Keep up the great work. I look forward to the podcast every week. I've been following Kristen Jordan since her Camerister days, so it was extra cool to see Levi on as a guest, JP.
We'll have him back.
Yeah.
Levi rules.
Hessel, this might be the Hessel we've had before. I don't know. I mean, maybe more than one person has the same name. I don't know. That is how
humanity works.
Is it? Okay. Hessel loves the podcast. Here's a speak pipe.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Jordan. Hi, Jaron. What's up, peepees? This is Hessel from Maastricht again, and I just wanted to share an anecdote on the RX 10 Mark IV concerning bridge cameras. The RX 10 Mark IV is actually one of the only cameras that have constantly sold out in our store. I work part-time in an old-school shop here in Maastricht. And it's a bit long in the tooth, so I really hope they bring out an update. But something that's been overlooked often is that there's a lot of DSLR users that didn't migrate towards a mirrorless system, but instead opted to go for the bridge cameras. And the RX-10 sort of being the Rolls Royce under bridge cameras, there's a lot of people that flock towards that. So I really hope that Sony will pick up that line again, bring out a Mark V, because it could really use a new battery, joystick, and autofocus system. So yeah, just my anecdote on that. Cheers. Thanks, guys.
Yes, you know, it's interesting. We've
vindicated.
Well, what were you?
I said last week, like, I really think there's a market for these cameras.
Okay, well, there you go. Please, that made Jordan happy. People are interested.
Really underestimate photographers who are like paying attention to the cutting edge, and people who like watch tech channels about photography like ours really underestimate how many photographers are still using DSLRs and have had no experience with mirrorless at all.
Right.
There are a lot of them, and a lot of them are still like working pros. And like, this is a good point. You have to really consider this. Like, I don't know why. Maybe it's the numbers just aren't there. They see sales numbers, yeah. So they have to know. But like, it stinks.
I'm still going to preface this what I'm about to say by saying I think it's always been about the right tool for the right job. And so for some people, a bridge camera is the right tool. But I have been in the past and will continue to be a huge proponent for moving from an SLR to a full interchangeable mirrorless camera system.
I know you've been one. You beat that
really,
drum hard.
I really do think that is probably the way to go for most people. I do.
But there are some who will be well served by bridge cameras, and I'd love to see updates.
Sure.
Because even just the most basic, bringing their latest autofocus, their latest battery tech, like he just said, would suddenly make these very contemporary.
Yes.
And yeah, they're very useful.
But that's limited to a small minority of people or the one Hessel that exists in the world. All right, our next Never Read the Comment. On Sigma Video, there seems to be a lot of people who have this belief that Sigma is choosing to ignore Nikon and Canon mirrorless mounts.
I put this note in there. There was like a lot of comments that are like, why isn't Sigma bringing this to Nikon?
It's not
Sigma.
They would love to.
It's Nikon and Canon.
Yeah, it's like, it's so funny to me that they think that Sigma is deciding that, no, we don't want to cater to
Of course they do.
Of course they want to sell more lenses. Yeah. It's
Tamron does as well. This person asks, what about Tamron? Well, yeah, they absolutely want to as well. And it's, again, Canon's famous for closing down their mirrorless mount, and that might change. And Nikon does open up to some now. It's changing now. So, you know, your wishes may come true, but it's always been the fault of the first party, not the third party.
Yeah. Those were just two statements I found that were a group of people asking similar questions.
Yeah, Matthew Benoisky has an email here on the Sigma thing as well. What? No one-to-one magnification macro lens? How would Sigma fill that niche, or does the company not have a lens like that yet? Not really for mirrorless, but I'm sure that's going to happen.
Macro, this is a really good point because I said like the one thing Sigma's lacking is bright super telephotos. I don't tend to focus on macro as much because this is one lens where I think there's absolutely no harm in adapting. You're going to be manually focusing your one-to-one macros. There's no image quality penalty.
And they probably feel the same.
They're longer focal lengths. They're not going to be that much smaller. So yeah, I don't think they're prioritizing that. And I think that makes perfect sense. Eventually they will. Hopefully they come up with something interesting they can do to make it, you know, justify being mirrorless only. But for the time being, with most people, I'm saying like, just grab one of like the three fantastic Laowa macros.
Yeah,
it's sure. Manual focus anyways. They're available in every mount basically at this point. So do that.
Yeah. Well, there you go. We have done a fantastic car cast, I think, because Google Maps says we're 2 minutes away from our destination. Perfect timing. Jordan's crotch is still full of equipment, and we're now going to call it a day. Hey, guys.
Yeah, thanks for joining us on this. I said it was going to be a special episode because it is. It's not the podcast. It's the car cast. Maybe we'll do it again if this comes out. We'll see. I don't know how this is going to go.
All the lights are blinking. I think we did it, guys.
Can we cram the tallest guy into the back seat of a Honda Coupe next time, though? Because like my back hurts and I kind of want to throw up and I've got heart pain.
Thanks for joining us, guys. We'll catch you next time. Thanks again to OM System and for Neurofix for sponsoring this episode. See ya.
Bye.